a second here to talk about Session. I'm not going to talk about Session. I'll give you my perspective on Session. If you scaled it out of 1 out of 10, it would be about a 4.6. Nothing great happened. Nothing terrible happened. We survived another one. It's over. We have a full year before the legislature will go back into session. So, you know, your businesses will continue without crazy things happening from the government right now. Anything that is out there is largely likely going to be signed by the governor. But I would say there were kind of two major issues that the state took on this year. One was the social media bill, which was going to ban anyone under 16 from being on social media. I'm sure that the governor will probably sign that new bill. It's unconstitutional and will be quickly thrown out by the courts after you and I spend $3 million of our tax dollars. Apparently nowhere in the Constitution does it say that your right to free speech and association comes with an age limit. And largely the courts have thrown these out in other portions of the state and other portions of the country, and so you'll largely see that be thrown out. The Senate chose to focus on a bill called Live Healthy, which I think is going to have some positive impacts, largely focused on providing more medical care, getting more doctor slots available in Florida, more nursing slots available in Florida. And I think that will have some good public policy impacts. But where I think the legislature missed is talking about all the really big important issues that everybody really cares about. And so, you know, if we did a poll in Florida and we said, what are the big issues of Florida? It would be property insurance, transportation, criminal justice, housing, probably not in that order, probably be housing and insurance, depending on where you live, or one and two, economy and things of that nature. And for the most part, the legislature chose not to address that this year. And I'm not sure why. I think largely it's you have a lot of new members, they're just kind of getting their footing on what the big issues are and trying to understand the big issues. But my big takeaway after doing 12 years in Tallahassee, I started in 2010 and left in 2022 because of term limits, was everything in Tallahassee is tactical. There is no strategy. If anybody could define for me what the strategy is on property insurance, it isn't working. If anybody can describe for me what the Florida state's policy, strategy is for affordable housing, good luck. It isn't working either. Same on the prison system. Same on transportation. We are operating the third largest state, one of the largest economies in the world, without a strategy. And that's a problem. And part of that is structural. It's a structural problem that the state of Florida has that obviously many other states, I would argue, don't have. And that is term limits. Not that I'm against term limits. I'm somebody who supports term limits. I think ours are too short. We have 8-year term limits. I really think they need to be 12. But it's more than that. It's really that the legislative leadership is only going to be there for 2 years and really only effective for about 18 months because the entire whatever term is left now of the Senate President and Speaker's term between now and November is basically just lame duck time. There's nothing going to happen. No effective policy is going to be passed largely between now and then. And so 18 months of policy... 18 months of effectiveness. I want you to imagine your organization where you change the leaderships every 18 months. And you'd wonder how effective your organization is going to be because the next leader may come in with 180-degree views. In fact, actually, I've seen it where Senate presidents have spent their entire 2 years to get a piece of policy across. I'm thinking of Bill Galvano with a piece of policy called MCORS, which was going to build some new roads throughout Florida. And then we get new Senate President Wilton Simpson, whose first priority is to completely undo everything that the prior Senate President just did on housing, on transportation policy. And we're going to see that system play out over and over again in Florida. And that's a structural challenge that we face. So after I left the legislature and had that perspective that everything is Tallahassee is tactical, there is no strategy, I decided, you know, like most legislators just kind of go off into the ether after they leave public office or they run for county commission so they can get their high five and get a pension when they retire. So I decided to start a nonprofit called the Florida Policy Project. And the Florida Policy Project focuses on best practices in 4 areas of public policy. They may sound familiar. Housing, property insurance, transportation, and criminal justice. Just those four areas. Because what I'm trying to get the state to understand and get to is this status of we're going to adopt the best practices in the country. A lot of areas of Florida, we are not anywhere near the best practice. We don't have to go beyond the best practice. We just have to get to the best practice. And as a legislator, I will tell you that in most cases, people don't even know where to start to look for the best practice. Case in point, we have some of the finest public universities in the country in Florida, as at least public universities, University of Florida, Florida State, incredibly difficult to get into, packed full of bright professors that are helping educate the future generations. Let me tell you how many times as a legislator, one of the universities came to me with a solution for a bigger problem. And the answer is zero. We will give the universities millions, hundreds of millions of dollars every year, and yet we require nothing from them. And in fact, we're not even asking them to help us solve some of these big problems. Now, it's not that they're not doing research. I mean, listen, USF is got more grants and one is with a top-tier university, University of Florida, Florida State. These are top-tier universities for research. And they tout that we're a tier one research institution. But none of that research is getting conveyed to legislators in a way that affects public policy. I went to the University of Florida to talk to them about some transportation policy, and they're saying we're doing great work on elderly with cataracts. And we have a whole driving simulator to help people that are elderly with cataracts figure out how to drive. And I'm like, that's, you know, and how they're dealing with it. And I'm like, that's great. What about I-4 traffic? What are we doing on that? Right? And the answer is nothing. Why? Because nobody is curious and asking about it. I love that we're sitting here under the aircraft here. I'm a pilot. One of the rules of flying is to stay ahead of the airplane. So you think ahead of the airplane, you want to stay ahead, you want to be putting in your radio frequencies ahead of time, your navigation waypoints in ahead of time. You want to be in front of the aircraft, because if you get behind, things get really busy and you miss something and you make mistakes, not the catastrophic mistakes, but you're going to make a mistake and it's suboptimal. And oftentimes what I feel like is the legislature is behind. They aren't staying in front of Florida. They're not researching and they're not curious about what's going on in Florida right now or curious about the answers to some of these problems. So this year, if we said insurance and housing are some of the top issues of the state of Florida, do you know how many current research projects we have in the state of Florida going on directed by the legislature on either one of those issues? Zero. Zero, which is shocking. So the Florida Policy Project was set up to focus on those major issues. On criminal justice, We're not taking on the hard stuff. We're taking on the low-hanging fruit, because under DeSantis' administration, we're not going to change sentencing laws. We're unlikely to bring back parole. We're not going to deal with what in Florida is the 85% rule, which means if you go to prison in Florida, you're going to serve 85% of your time, no matter if you're a violent offender or a non-violent offender. Everybody's going to serve his time. And the Florida prison system is falling apart. One of the last things I did before I left the legislature was put in a report on the current status of the prison system, what's going on in the Florida prison system. And what that report says, because it came out in December of 2023, after KPMG, which is a global consulting firm, did an exhaustive study on the Florida prison system, is they said, your prison system is falling apart. You need to spend $2.2 billion immediately on the prison system. You have prisons that have blue tarps on their roofs and are leaking water. You have plumbing systems that don't work. You have hot water that doesn't turn on in the prison system. And 75% of your prisons are not air conditioned. This is a problem. And by the way, most of your facilities, and many of you may not know this, most of the facilities of prisons in Florida are located in North Florida. Unfortunately, we do not have a labor pool in North Florida to support your prison systems anymore, because 30 years ago, they were established as a rural jobs program. And unfortunately, we've seen this rural to urban flight. So what ultimately has happened is we have prison facilities in Florida where they can't staff. They're only reaching a 34% staffing ratio at any given time. A lot of the prisons have 60% vacancies of corrections officers. And a corrections officer is in Florida, 40% of them will leave within the first year, and 60% within the second year. So we have a very hard time, a challenging time, addressing the corrections issues of the state, where we have a prison system that's falling apart, that is understaffed, that's overstuffed, and has essentially no programs or services. Nobody will tell you that's a best practice. And when you're released from the prison system, what do you get? You get $50 and a bus pass. Unadjusted for inflation, it's been $50 and a bus pass for 20 years. And we wonder why people are living under a bridge. And we wonder why people come out of prison with as much or more trauma than they walked into the prison system with. It's a major challenge. On housing, we've looked at housing and we've come away with kind of one big takeaway. And that is this: if cities and counties don't fix zoning, you will not fix housing. In Pinellas County, this is especially profound because we're a peninsula on a peninsula. The only place for us to go is up or increase density where we're at. And so what kind of conversations are we having at the city level to increase density? The mayor of Tampa has come out and said publicly that she wants to build, or she's going to build, 10,000 units. 10,000 units during her administration. That's what was her claim. I'm currently in the process of building some apartments in St. Petersburg that are affordable. And I can tell you, you cannot build a unit of apartment in St. Petersburg for less than $300,000. Cannot happen. Now, I think that's fascinating because $300,000 is actually an interesting number for me, because I remember when my parents in 1987 wanted to build a brand new home. And I specifically remember my dad walking into my mom and saying, "Mary, if you keep adding to this house, it's going to cost $300,000. That was like my first memory of money. And now I'm building 264 units, and you can't build one of them, one unit, for less than $300,000. And therein lies the challenge of housing that Pinellas County finds itself in. And we have to have some difficult conversations with our neighbors about upzoning, about accessory dwelling units. These are garage apartments. It's the shortest putt in housing. And we have to be kind of an all-hands-on-deck discussion about how we're going to have, how we're going to meet these housing challenges. If you go talk to the president of John Hopkins All Children's or Bayfront, and you say, "What are some of your biggest challenges?" They're like, "We don't have a place for our $20 an hour employees or $25 an hour employees to live. That they're having to live across the bridge and commute every day. There is no way for them to live close by. So if we don't fix zoning, we don't fix housing. And there are strategies we can implement. There are best practices from around the country that include upzoning, that include accessory dwelling units, that include things like smaller lot sizes." And I would argue that largely we have kind of moved away from racial discrimination in America in many ways, but what we have is social discrimination, and that we did that via lot sizes. And if you think about it, that's what's occurred. In many areas, look, if you're building new developments around in Hillsborough or in other places, you have to have this minimum lot size of a quarter acre or eighth acre. That's crushing people, because by the time you add that $300,000 cost to that $100,000 lot size, now all of a sudden we've put people, many people in that missing middle, out of housing. So we have to have a conversation about housing that includes upzoning and includes accessory dwelling units. And yes, you need apartments, but I like to think of housing as a pyramid. You actually need housing at the top, the middle, and the bottom. Because if you don't have enough housing at the top for those people that are in the 1%, 5% that are buying those high-end homes, what do? Well, they move into the middle, and they push people out of the middle. And if you don't have enough housing at the bottom, what do? Well, the people in the middle push the people out of the housing pyramid at the bottom. And now, with the legislature and its infinite wisdom saying people can't sleep on the streets, where do people go? Well, it means we're going to have to establish camps. Well, it's unlikely that the camps that the state establishes are going to let you have drugs or alcohol in them. And so those individuals who come in with a drug or alcohol problem are unlikely to be able to be housed inside the camps. But they can't live in the streets, so where do they go? They go to the jails? What do you think is going to happen to the jails? The jails fill up. Oftentimes, and this happens over and over again, we fail to ask the question, what happens next? And then, and this leads us to these kind of outcomes, where while, sure, I think everybody would generally agree, we would prefer if homeless did not sleep on the streets. We then go, all right, well, what are our options? And if it was one thing if the state would say, okay, you can't sleep on the streets, but also we're going to provide cities and counties resources to ensure that it's not falling on their taxpayers because of our policy decision. Now, all of a sudden, what they've done is set up a massive set of tort claims for citizens to be able to sue their local governments because they're going to find people sleeping on the streets. And they're going to say, you did not put enough resources towards this to solve these problems. So affordable housing is a major issue that we did not address this year, that we know what the solutions are. And if Tallahassee really wanted to get involved in this and really wanted to solve this problem, they would change the incentives. Many of you have heard about Live Local. That was the big bill last year. They have Live Healthy this year, Live Local last year. And I will argue Live Local was a step in the right direction, but is a 3% solution with a 97% of the problem left untouched. Live Local is great for apartment developers. Gives them lots of flexibility, lets them bypass a lot of local zoning. But you also have counties that are fully rejecting it, like it's an organ that's totally being rejected. Places like Pasco, which have historically, in the last few years, had a moratorium on new apartments. Imagine that, like a moratorium, like you can't build a new apartment in the southern half of the county. What do you think is going to happen with rents? It isn't like those 1,000 people a day that are moving to Florida are not coming here, and they're definitely, you know, and they're not going to want to find a place to live. So what happens? Rent goes up. In the same breath, they're begging, screaming for Tallahassee to provide us more resources for affordable housing. Well, at some juncture, physician, heal thyself, right? You've got to be able to have a strategy in place, and it's because we don't have the proper aligned incentives from Tallahassee to the cities and counties that help address affordable housing issues. Finally, we're going to talk about property insurance. This is one of the single largest challenges the state faces right now. And if you've been following this, Florida has lost 12 companies in the last 36 months. 9 to bankruptcy, a few have pulled out. And a few more are selling their books off right now and trying to leave the state. You haven't heard about them, but they're doing it right now. They're actively working to get out of the state. Citizens, which is kind of the thermometer that I use as to the health of the Florida market, is at 1.3 million policies. This is after people have taken out 200,000 policies this year. Private market took out 200,000 policies, but they're projected to be back at 1.3 million policies. Citizens has about $10 billion in cash. $10 billion in cash and $580 billion of exposure, of total exposure. Concentrated predominantly in Miami-Dade, Broward, Tampa Bay, Hillsborough, Pasco. If any of those counties see a large storm, assessments are coming. And you're already paying double, triple what you were 5 or 6 years ago. Apartment developers were paying $500 a door 6 or 7 years ago for insurance. I saw a quote the other day for $3,000 a door for insurance. I mean, imagine you're paying a month and a half's of rent just to cover the insurance on your apartment. This is unsustainable. But again, this is Tallahassee. Citizens Property Insurance has 60% market share of homes below $600,000 in the Tampa Bay market. Why? Because they're priced at half the private market. So think about how politically unpopular it is to go to Tallahassee and say, listen, we need to move to actuarially sound rates. We need to move to market rates for our property insurance, which is a part of the solution. Well, then, because we've let it go so far, we would have to raise rates 100%. Because if you're 50% below something, in order to get back up there, you've got to raise rates 100%. That is never going to happen. Politically, would throw everybody out of office that they raised the, you know, on 60% of the population of Pinellas County, 100%. So how do we make these moves? It's a major challenge. And what we've found at the Florida Policy Project is this. There wasn't even a document you could go to. Like, there's not one single place you can go to that kind of walks people through how the Florida property insurance market actually works. And so we created that. And you'll see that coming out in a couple weeks, a primer on Florida property insurance. We're working on solutions on condos right now. It's a major issue right now. Condos have had this kind of double whammy. Surfside, which the legislature then said, because what was happening at condos was everybody was deferring their reserves. They're like, this is bad, but this is true. They're like, I'm 84 years old. I don't need to pay. I can't afford to pay a $20,000 assessment. Let's defer it for a few years, and then I'll sell this thing on to somebody else. It'll be their problem, not mine. That's what was happening. It was happening all over the state of Florida. And so we had condos like Surfside and many others around the state that had radically insufficient reserves. So what did the state do? It said, well, no, you can't do that anymore. And we're going to give you 3 years to fill your reserves back up. Oh, and the same time, you need to go get an inspection on your properties. And we need to understand what's really going on there. So what happened? Their reserve requirements went way up. And their mandate that they either pay a penalty or fully fund their reserves, it went up. At the same time, inflation went up, so the cost of rebuilding these buildings has gone up dramatically, and your property insurance has gone up accordingly to go into there, to that space. There's a reason why you're going to see condos in Florida be repriced, fundamentally repriced, why assessments have gone through the roof. And we're talking about people on fixed income who for years have paid a very stable and steady assessment who now simply cannot afford to live in their home anymore. And this speaks to the fact that what happened? We got behind the airplane. We were not staying out in front of this. We weren't doing the research. We weren't doing the studies necessary to focus on these problems. So I'll stop there and I'll take some Tiger questions and we'll rock and roll.
Thank God it's Lent. We have two sponsors this year. One is the Raise Rowdies Foundation. Thank you for your support. And the other sponsor is our club. Our club folks, thank you. We're going to do a question and answer period with Jeff first, and then we're going to have Rep. Cross come and then do a question and answer period. So, Young Tigers are invited to ask a question, and only members of the club are invited to ask a question. Ask a question, state your name, sit down, please. And so the Young Tigers are from St. Pete High School today. They're here with their chaperone. Will you please stand, if you don't mind? And I'm sorry I don't have my notes in front of you. Will you say your name?
Ryan Lang,
St. Pete High. Lane. Are you Lang Lang, the Lang family? You know what I mean. I'll talk to you later. I'm sorry. Go ahead. Thank you. All you St. Pete High folks know what that name means, Lane. I feel sorry for you. My son has to deal with the same thing. But question and answers, members, and I'm going to get the mic to Harvey, and then I'm going to get the senator a mic.
Harvey Landris, thank you very much for coming. We appreciate your short-term notice. You did a good presentation. The Florida legislature has passed a bill that is overriding many local ordinances that is having an impact on local government. Is this a good idea or a bad idea, and why?
You're talking generally or specifically?
They've passed a number of things that are impacting local government, mm-hmm. and proposing even more to restrict local government ability to pass local ordinances.
Yeah.
What do you support?
So where am I at on, generally on preemption? I guess that's the
yes.
question, right? Like, where do you stand generally on
yes.
preemption? And I'm going to give you, I'm not an attorney, but I'll give you an attorney answer. It depends.
Give us a legislative answer.
Let me give you an example. It took me 4 years. I worked on Uber and Lyft in Florida. Pretty important topic. It took me 4 years to pass Uber and Lyft through the state of Florida. And what we found was, in Hillsborough County had the Hillsborough Transportation Commission, this esteemed body of people who, full-time job, getting paid hundreds of thousands of dollars a year, was to manage the taxi system of Hillsborough County. And they had a provision that says if you wanted to go into Hillsborough, you had to have a license. And in some of the cities in Pinellas County had a provision, St. Pete wouldn't be one of them, that if you wanted to operate a taxi in this community, you had to have a license. And some other smaller cities along the beach had these same provisions. And it would be impossible to operate a Uber or Lyft style transportation system if you had to have a license to operate in every single county, licensed by the individual car. And so in that case, preemption made a lot of sense to say, listen, when it comes to transportation, you should be able to cross county lines and access a government-funded airport without having to pay all of these extra fees to be part of it. But there are plenty of things where the state has preempted a local government that I don't support, I'm sure Rep. Cross doesn't support, that that are inappropriate for us to do that. And the challenge for me is, where do we draw the lines? Apparently, the governor the line was not plastic straws, right? Because the state tried to preempt plastic straws, and the governor said, whoa, that's too far, right? But Gainesville tried to pass a local bill and a local ordinances that would allow for upzoning. And the governor stepped in and said, no, you can't do that. So there again, I'm not sure where their true north is on preemption and local control. I think, you know, Tallahassee largely sees cities and counties as essentially subdivisions of the larger development of the state of Florida. And so it really depends, and you never really know what they're willing to preempt and what they're not. I think there are things that definitely need to be preempted. 5G is one. Like, you would never have 5G if you had every city and county doing certain things. I think local preferences tend to be an issue, where you could have the city of Gulfport that says, we're going to have a local preference for our developers or for our builders that build with our city. But there's only two of them, right? And they're gonna and the people in St. Petersburg that have a development business or a construction company would never meet their local preference kind of guidelines. And what we've seen is that tends to raise prices by about 15% on construction of units and housing and other things, just by having local preferences. It should be, if you're a state contractor, that state contractor license should apply radically throughout the state. Unfortunately, certain cities and counties have local preference rules where they don't want that to happen. And I think that's another area where I think generally people could find a way to support preempting those things. So I think it just depends.
Okay, any young Tigers or members who want to ask a question? Because then David's going to bring Rep. Cross in. And young Tigers, you're good.
Andrake McMullen, Senator, thank you so much for being here, especially in such short notice. One of the issues you talked about that you didn't touch on was transportation. What do you see as some solutions, and where do you see autonomous vehicles fitting in, and maybe autonomous air vehicles fitting into that?
So there's three megatrends happening in transportation right now. The world's getting more shared, it's getting more electric, and it's getting more automated. You see this, I think of it as decades. So 2010 to 2020 was the decade of the shared economy. You got Uber, Lyft, DoorDash, all the other fun things that we now order are available on our smartphones. Happened from 2010 to 2020. 2020 to 2030 is the decade of electrification. And I think you're going to see, you know, you might see 20% of all new cars sold by 2030 being electric, which I think is substantial. Now, we only transition about 6% of the U.S. auto fleet any given year. So it's not going to hit you like a ton of bricks. It's 20% of 6%. Of the U.S. auto system, but there is this huge transition coming in transportation, And then 2030 and beyond, you're going to see a lot more of the automation, predominantly in three areas. Trucking will be automated. We can't hiring truck drivers right now is very difficult, and so trucking is an area. Mining operations, kind of things that are in that world, and ports. And then the one place people don't think about is agriculture, right? These kind of combines on demand. Agriculture is largely going to be fully automated. If any of you have seen the movie Interstellar, where you know, Matthew McConaughey is out there in the field and the tractors start doing interesting things, it was because, and they were all automated. That's the world we're moving to, is this automated and teleoperations in agriculture. And that's how we're gonna feed the world in the future, is that ability. The best money we could spend right now in transportation is on something that is incredibly simple, but is something that you'd be shocked to know how difficult it would actually be to pull off for a lot of cities and counties right now. And that is timing your signals correctly. It's true, the best ROI in all of transportation is getting signals timed correctly. But if you go over right now to the city of Tampa, 70% of the traffic light boxes are simple timers and are not adjustable, are not variable from an external source. And so Floor Policy Project is working with actually Google, with their Google Greenlight project, to use Google Map data. We have a project going right now with District 5 in Florida that's working with them specifically on this issue of signal light timing. And you're gonna see a report coming out from us. We just worked with Cutter at Center for Urban Research and Transportation in Hillsborough on this topic of signal light timing. But transportation is one of those, it's a fascinating issue. It's you're starting to see more and more electric vehicles every day. But you're also starting to see the challenges of EVs. For example, Hertz said we're going into EVs, and then they fired their CEO, and now they're getting out of EVs because EVs are really expensive to maintain when it comes to an accident and getting repair parts and things of that nature. And people, just driver adoption has not shown that. So it's a fascinating topic that I think we can do a lot more work in. Last question, and then I'll turn it over across.
Phil Clark. So you said something really interesting about prison reform.
And there we go. And that we're looking more towards serving 85% of sentences, but at the same time, prisons are falling apart and we can't find enough people to staff them. So how do you balance that, where we're going to have people spending more time in prison but don't have the location and the people to serve it? I think it was Churchill that says that democracies tend to do the right thing after they've exhausted all other options. And I think that's where we'll get to. I think you're gonna find the state of Florida getting to a stage space, kind of where California, Alabama got, where essentially they've run out of options. Because not only are we getting more people in the prison system is graying very quickly. It's getting a lot older. The average inmate costs about $23,000 for an 18 to 25-year-old to house. For someone over the age of 65, that number gets to be $60,000 or $70,000 or $80,000 a year. And all of that delta is healthcare costs. And you know, when you're having to provide dialysis and when you're having to provide other services, cancer treatment, things of that nature for people that are incarcerated, that are frankly unlikely to commit new crimes. There aren't a lot of 75-year-old bank robbers, right? They're unlikely to commit new crimes, but we have no effective way of transitioning out of the system. So I think Florida, look, we were told we needed $2.2 billion immediately. We put in less than 5% of that, $100 million, which is radically more than they spent last year, 10 times more than they spent last year, but nowhere near what they need immediately. Immediately to Tallahassee apparently means within 20 years. And so what you're gonna find is we're going to get to a situation, one, we're going by 1,000 people a day. Some of those people are gonna commit crimes. Where the jails are gonna start filling up, your prisons are gonna be filled up, you can't hire enough staff. Many people don't know this, we have 300 members of the Florida National Guard on full-time duty. They're now permanent members of the Department of Corrections. Because if they didn't have those 300 members, what would have to happen is the state would have to issue emergency releases. And those people with a month left in their sentence, they would be shown the door tomorrow. And then we'd go to people with 2 months. The governor's never going to let that happen, especially when you're running for president of the United States. So we put in the National Guard to kind of fill the gap. That was supposed to be temporary. It's been 2 years. And there's no end in sight for where that will end. And that number may grow from 200 to 400 to 600. This is the situation that we're in. But it comes down to the same thing in housing, in transportation, in criminal justice, in property insurance. It starts with a vision and a plan. Florida has to come up with a strategy on these problems. The reason I led by saying we have a full year is because in order to stay ahead of the airplane, we've got to start now to prepare for next session. If we wait until June, July to start getting studies and research in, then we're way too late. So I'm actively working on this. My goal is, you know, what I've learned is you've got to work directly with leadership. So Sunday Monday afternoon, I'm going to be on a plane flying to Tallahassee, sitting down with Senate leadership, walking them through what we think some of the strategies should be to address some of these issues and trying to get research done on some of these things. Because if you don't start now, you'll never be there by March. Thank you all for your time. Great to see you.